listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by West Wave Audio, LA's new API dealer. And now from the Nowcast Network studios, here's Mike.
Hey, welcome to the Audio Nowcast. My name is Mike Rodriguez. And before we get going, I want to introduce the guys. And today we have with us Rob Arbiter.
Hello there, Mike.
And Martin Page.
Hi there, Mikey.
Bobby's not with us because Bobby's working, you know, trying to... One of us has to make money. and Scott's on vacation, so I think he's at Disneyland today.
He certainly is.
So good old Scott at Disneyland. Today we're going to be doing a really special show. We're going to be talking about songwriting. Not only are we going to be talking about songwriting, but we're also going to be talking about being a songwriter. And we really have the best person, you know, as far as I'm concerned, in the world to give us all the information and advice that we have, and that's with Martin. So Martin is our special guest today, Martin.
Homemade crowd.
Without Scott, we have to do our own sound effects, you know?
So the one thing that, you know, gives Martin the credits to sit here and be the authority is he came up with the world-famous line, slow, slow, quick, quick, slow.
The world famous.
That's right. If anybody can compose that lyric, they deserve to be here.
And that took me 5 years to get
that. One year per word.
But Martin, why don't you just tell everybody a little bit about yourself and kind of some of the stuff that you've done, because you've written with a lot of different people. You've written some really classic songs like These Dreams with Heart, and why don't you just tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, thank you, Mike, for that wonderful introduction. We'll pay you after, there's no doubt about that. But the song you're mentioning, Quick Quick Slow, that brought myself and my band across from England in the 80s. That was a song called Dancing in Heaven. We were a band called Q-Feel, and K-Rock in the 80s broke that record. And that brought myself and my band across, as I said, from England to Los Angeles. And at that time, it was a wonderful time to come because a lot of the American artists and bands and producers were looking to change their sound. And in the 80s, it was really the sound of Tom Dolby, Thompson Twins. It was the electro sounds that were coming in. It was drum machines. Everything was changing. Bit of a revolution. And my band was a little bit like that. And lo and behold... when that record broke through in LA, myself and my partner, Brian Fairweather, got a chance to meet up with all the artists and producers that were looking to change their sound. And so it was like a university education. I'd always been a fan of American music, and I found myself working with my heroes at that time. After Dancing in Heaven, I had a chance to work with Bernie Taupin, who was Elton's lyricist, and we luckily, on our first two efforts together, wrote We Built the City for Starship and These Dreams for Heart. And that, to make a long story reasonably short at the beginning here, led me on to working with many artists that I loved at that time, Earth, Wind & Fire, the Commodores. We were able to work with Barbara Streisand and Neil Diamond. And it was just really an amazing time to be here because not only were we getting cuts and I was able to... learn my trade even better with American writers. It was really a great learning process, and ever since then I've been here writing.
Didn't you also you worked on the Ghostbusters too, right?
Yeah, actually that's an interesting story because that was the first thing that I actually did when I came to LA. I actually played a Casio keyboard on Ray Parker's demo actually for Ghostbusters, and Brian, my partner, played guitar, and that was the first. We were only in LA for about a week, and there we were in the studio recording Ghostbusters. And in fact, when we were playing the track, we were even then thinking, "This sounds like Huey Lewis."
And we all know how well that went.
Well, Ghostbusters was a huge hit, but at the time we were doing it, we had no idea that that was going to be such a big record. And in fact, I thought, this doesn't sound good at all, what we're playing. And then, lo and behold, within about a week, it was on in all the movie theaters, and it was number one. So we thought, this is a great place to be, L.A., we shall stay here. And that led me on, really, from working with Ray Parker to working with a lot of the R&B bands I loved, like, as I said, Earth, Wind & Fire and the Commodores.
Was there ever a time you consciously made a decision to go from a performer to a songwriter? Or how does that work? Because I know a lot of people, when they think about being a songwriter, a lot of people think it's failed musicians, you know. And in reality, it's been my experience that it's the other way around. The songwriters are usually the genius behind a lot of the artists that are out there. You know, you don't find too many artists that write their own songs. And Rob, you're just now starting doing songwriting and developing talent. And was there a decision, Martin, at what point in your career did you see it going more towards songwriting and less towards your band?
Well, back in England, In around the 70s, I was basically playing a lot of bands live, and I was playing bass guitar. And I started to realize in all the bands I was playing with that we desired a record deal, but we never got the record deal. And it came down to always the thing was with the material. Was the material strong enough? Was it good enough? And it dawned on me, even though I was playing in these bands, that the material and the songs were the lifeblood of even getting a record deal. So I made a conscious effort when I was actually playing in groups to try and write material for the band. I was very aware that every time we went to London to do auditions, that it wasn't how good the band looked. It wasn't as you know, if the band played well. It was, do we have the songs? So it dawned on me that songs were really the lifeblood. They were the treasure of the music business. And so I started to concentrate on writing songs around that time, before I even came to America. It happened to me that I realized that to have, for my bands that I was playing with to get a record deal, that it was going to come down to the song. So I started to concentrate on writing. That was in the 70s. And after about 5 years, the song started to get a little stronger, a little bit better. And we were able, myself and my partner, to get a publishing deal in London. But, it really came down to, as a kid, I loved records. I loved the Beatles. I loved anything that was on a 45 record, and I used to emulate that. Interestingly enough, when you first start to write, you are just really copying your heroes, and then after a while, you start to realize that you've got something to add yourself. But it really was important that the song was everything. The song was everything that made a band tick. Made a band get a record contract, and made a career happen. So to me, songwriting was definitely going to be the gold that you had to search for.
Do you remember the first time you heard one of your songs on the radio?
Oh yeah, I do actually. It was a very magical time because back in England, I think it was about 1980. I'd signed to a label called Jive Records. We were actually the first band to sign to Jive Records, and we were the first actual record on Jive Records. It was an awful song we released called Doctor on the Radio.
And, Doctor in the Radio?
Doctor on the Radio, Doctor, yes. Very famous song. I think we sold 5 copies in France. I'm still trying to find out the person who bought them. And the record company told us that we were going to get airplay, and it was going to be something like 2 o'clock in the morning on Radio 1. And so we told all our family, and we stayed up till 1 o'clock in the morning, and just we heard it. And boy, that was a big thrill. Biggest thrill in the world, actually, hearing something that you've written in your living room going out on the airwaves around the world. It's pretty special.
And how old were you when that happened?
78.
You're 78?
Yeah. Took a long time to break. Now, I think, you know, I was, I started.
I mean, were you a teenager? Were you in your 20s?
It was 19, 20, yeah, when the record, when our first record was recorded and we got our first airplay.
I ask that just because a lot of people wonder, you know, am I too old to do this? Yeah. Am I too young?
Well, actually, I started writing a little bit late as it goes, because I was playing in bands, you know, at the age of 16 on to 20, just being a musician. And I started to really concentrate on writing songs around sort of, you know, 19 to 20 years old. And really, when you think about it, this is an interesting thing that you brought up, Rob, that, you know, my first number one would have happened when I was, you know, 29 to 30. It takes a long time. It takes a long time. And you sort of monitor it. You go, my first song hit 42 in the charts, and now we've just broken the top 40, you know, but it's a long process. It's a long process. And I know we'll get talking about this, but it is absolutely, an addiction that you just want to write better songs. And it takes a while. It doesn't come overnight, as you know.
I'm probably the most envious of songwriters because they actually find a way to make music communicate an idea. And the first thing that I notice is to be a songwriter, you just need to have a really big passion for music. And to me, music is, you know, this is cliche, but it's the soundtrack for your life. And everybody remembers great songs, songs that touch them, songs that, that were important to them at a specific time. Did you know when you were younger that music affected you in that way?
I certainly did, Mike. I really did. It's, when I was a kid, living back in England, I always remember, you know, even from the earliest age, maybe being, you know, six or seven, that we'd have parties, Christmas parties at my house. We lived on a council estate, so all the neighbours used to come in and we'd play records. And my parents, you know, were playing records from, you know, the 50s and the 40s. And I started to hear, you know, Valare, and you'd hear Glenn Miller swing songs. And what really hit me was how music changed people. I always remember as a kid that I just thought this is a magical experience, because just putting on a piece of vinyl onto a record player, then everybody got on, everybody danced, everybody smiled. And I just noticed, to me, particularly if my parents were having an argument or they weren't doing well over, you know, in a relationship, when music was involved, the family changed. So even at the earliest stage, music, I thought, was an absolutely magical communicator. And I didn't know why. I was absolutely enamored with picking up a vinyl record and looking at the color of the label and reading in brackets the writers of a title of a song. And I thought, this, even without really knowing what it was, I thought, this is a piece of magic. It's an intangible art form. It's not like you can touch the painting. It's going through air. It's absolutely magical to me. It was a kind of communication without knowing where it had come from. It was quite spiritual, and I don't mean spiritual in a religious sense, but just like, wow, this is so free, and it's going through the air.
You know, I heard a really great definition of music, and the definition of music was, it's the physical incarnation of emotion,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
where if you were going to describe music to somebody, you would say it's emotion in a physical form.
I think you say emotion, and that's what hit me even as a kid. And of course, I was very lucky because I grew up in the 60s and around 66 when the Beatles were breaking through in England. I was watching TV when they were happening. And of course, the Beatles wrote great songs. And so I was right in the middle of seeing, you know, a revolution take place in Europe and on our TV sets. And so you lived with the Beatles at that time. And, you know, it was a revolution. And of course, you all wanted to be Paul McCartney or John Lennon. And as a kid, you went to school, you know, and you bought your plastic Beatles wig and you sang to all the girls hoping they'd follow you home, you know. So it was a very special time in England. I think I had two very special times in my career, which was the 60s, where the Beatles were happening and I was a kid right in the middle of it and becoming a fan. And then in the 80s, when I came to America and Los Angeles, it was again another kind of revolution for music, where we were bringing over drum machines. We were, two people were in a band. It wasn't, you know, it was the songwriter could be the guy who did the drum machine. It was a different kind of time again. So I think I had two very important eras in my career, very lucky for me.
That's kind of cool, because in the 80s they called it the second British invasion.
So. Totally true. And in fact, again, in the 80s, I was in LA writing for a lot of the English bands that came across looking to get songs. Because in England, we always thought that the best songs came from America. And Americans used to think maybe the best songs come from England. So I was in LA working with English bands. So I was writing with Go West at that time and wrote King of Wishful Thinking and Faithful for them. And I worked with Paul Young as well. So the timing was right for me. Here I was, an English guy in LA. I wasn't really a kind of music for hire, which a lot of the English bands were nervous of. So I was able to do the collaborations with a lot of the English artists that came to America looking for a slightly different sound, but still wanted it not to be too corporate.
So you're actually working not necessarily a lot with the American artists, but a lot with the English artists.
A real mixture. And in my career, because I'd had the success with the American artists first, you know, like working with Maurice White and Earth, Wind & Fire and on the Night Shift album with the Commodores, a lot of the English groups which were soulfully inspired, like Go West, like Paul Young, like, you know, Johnny Hates Jazz, bands like that, a lot of the English groups that wanted just that a little bit of American flavor would call on me, because I was luckily here and I'd already had experience writing hits, you know, and you know, getting into the business side, even though I never did it for that, people go, that's a hit songwriter, go and knock on his door. And because the English didn't really want to be doing, maybe should we say, a corporate kind of thing, getting involved in maybe just with Americans, they felt a little bit safer with me. So I had a really good place to work with them as well. It's a real mixture. And as I said to you before, Mike, I felt like I was at university because I was getting an opportunity to work with great American writers as well, like John Lind and, you know, Maurice White, and working with Peter Wolfe, the producer who took my songs to heart, and the Commodores. And then you, you know, you're sat in a room with Barbara Streisand rearranging a song. And it was all quite unreal to me because, I never came to this songwriting technically. I came purely through naive inspiration. I wasn't a trained, I taught myself from listening to records. I emulated records. I never went to music school or anything. It was purely buy a guitar songbook and learn the chords, buy an Elton John songbook and learn the piano chords. And from that, you know, you write your own songs.
How intimidating was it to be there rearranging a song with Barbara Streisand?
It was a very funny experience because, Maurice White, because I'd worked with him on his solo album, was about to produce, Barbara Streisand, and I'd written a song called Time Machine, which he wanted her to record. So we had to go to her house, myself, my partner, and Maurice White, and sit around the piano while she worked the song up with us. And Brian and I, we went to her house, and it was like all the other producers were there as well. So it was like a living room full of people waiting for her to arrive, like the Queen's about to arrive. And everybody was really tense, like she's going to come down. She's about to come into the room. And Brian and I were like two kids in a candy shop. We were just giggling like idiots, you know. and her management was trying to control us and say, hey, not too much humor here. You know, she's about to come in the room. But when she came in the room, she could see that we were the giggling fools in the corner, and she instantly gravitated to us, and we had a good laugh with her. When you love music so much, even though you're about to work with your idols, because Bernie Taupin, Elton John, Peter Gabriel were my heroes, and I was able to get work with them. You love music so much that you sort of, you're excited about it, but at the same time, the song, as we're talking about, was still the most important thing. You had to make the song work. So even though you were just absolutely thrilled to be with these people, the song was the thing that brought you to them. Right. So, you know, you had to honor the song all through it. But it was a great, great, great learning experience. And that actually led me on to working with Robbie Robertson from the band and Bob Dylan. And that was, again, a total change of style for me in songwriting. So I just thought I was going through a really great education of working with many different styles.
The only other one that I want to ask you about, because you know what, I've never asked you these questions before. How was it working with the Commodores on the Night Shift album? I mean, that's such a great album.
That was again, you know, the Commodores are one of my heroes from England, because when I first started playing in bands, I played a bass guitar and I played all the American air basses with neo-English funk bands. And we were playing Brick House and all of the Commodores hits. And then, you know, 5 years later, you're in the studio working with them. And it was, again, a big thrill. Lionel Richie had already left them, so this was like a comeback album without him. But I wrote two tracks on that album, Animal Instinct and Lay Back. And, of course, the Night Shift song did very well for them. And, you know, if I talked about my heroes, it would have been probably in the R&B world. It would have been the Commodores and Earth, Wind & Fire. And, of course, Stevie Wonder, who Rob works with. I never got to work with Stevie, but you know, the Commodores and Earth, Wind & Fire were really an Englishman's heritage back then.
If you were here the last podcast, you would have been in a room where most people had worked with Stevie Wonder.
Yeah, it was a pretty big club.
One thing that I've also noticed about you, Martin, is that with your songwriting, it's not just a profession, it's a way of life. Because I've been around you and you know, I've been through some of your good times and some of your hard times that you've had in this last couple of years. And I've really seen how your music has kind of, in some ways, been therapy for you through life. And that's just taken music on a whole nother level that I think totally shows in the honesty of a lot of the songs that you wrote. How important is your craft of songwriting to your life? I mean, where does that play in your whole psyche of Martin Page?
Well, it's exactly what you say, Mike. It's therapy to me. I came to music, you know, as a naive fan, and I've tried to keep that all the way through. You know, I really haven't ever sat down and tried to write music for it to be just commercially successful. It's lovely if it is, and you like to keep that in the back of your mind that you're trying to appeal to a lot of people. But it's always been emotional to me because, you know, there are people that have inspired me through my career, and their songs have inspired me. And it's usually been, you know, the most emotional songs that have got me. I would say, like, Peter Gabriel, with most of his career, has been, you know, truthful songs. Elton John, you know, the best moments will be probably the most emotional for me. And I found that writing songs is the one place where I totally lose myself. I don't know what's going on in the world. I don't know what's going on with my body. I don't know what's going on outside. I'm totally lost in what I think somebody would say probably is a kind of spiritual, meditational kind of place. Now, I'm not talking about religion at all. I'm just talking about that you're totally lost in a magical, creative place. And I know that everybody finds this in their lives at different times. I find that writing songs does that for me because it's an intangible art. You're searching for something. You're not sure what it is. You've got a pathway and a gate that's opening up in front of you. Yeah, you never know really what you're going to come up with. You can never ask a songwriter really totally, you know, how do you do this? Because there is a method, but what's going to come is in, you know, the lap of the gods. You just, as over time, your experience helps you get to a certain place. But where that magical melody comes from, where that creative lyric comes from, is always keeps you on your toes, keeps you thrilled. I mean, as you pointed out, I've had some dark times in my life, and I haven't been able to write through those periods very well. And it's actually, I've gone very numb when, you know, you lose people through death and whatever, that numbness takes place. But always, the one thing that brought me a little nearer to healing was writing music. It was the one place where, as I said before, I could lose myself. The same way an athlete might be, you know, when he's running, he loses himself. The same way, you know, a singer, when they're singing, they lose themselves. And that's what songwriting does for me. I find that it's actually, and it sounds very grand, and I don't mean it that way, but I feel like I'm touching something beyond myself when I'm trying to put three or four chords together. And because I don't understand how it works, that's what makes it even more special.
Well, you know, you definitely do touch people beyond that moment. I'll never forget being in Germany when we did that one show at
Nuremberg, wasn't it?
Nuremberg, there you go. In Nuremberg, we're in Germany, you were singing The Door, and that's a song about the Holocaust in front of a German crowd, and that, boy, talk about being in a moment and with a song touching 100,000 people. It was really amazing. It just gave me chills up and down. So I imagine as a songwriter, it's those kind of moments. That's like the goal. That's like, that's just the ultimate in feedback.
You know, it's, I mean, it was a wonderful tour, and to have you, Mike, involved with that and to be there at that time. This is an interesting thing again about songwriting. You know, I made my first solo album, you know, a good sort of 10 years ago after, you know, writing for 20 years for other people. And I wouldn't have been able to have written a song like The Door, which is about the Treblinka and the Holocaust, or the whole album In the House of Stone and Light about, you know, spiritual recovery, unless I'd gone through 20 years of writing before that. And only now, here I am at this point, you know, about to put out another solo record. I'm not the fastest, but you tend to feel that your songs get a little more personal as you go on in time. You tend to learn some more ways of communicating more truthful as you get older. And I just feel that on songs like The Door or The House of Stone and Light, or should we say Peter Gabriel's Biko, or should we say, you know, Elton John's, for instance, Ticking, songs like that really have a sense of going beyond just writing the 3-minute hit single. When you get a chance to write a song like that that has a message, and as you say, Mike, to sing it to an audience, which is even that country that had been through that, you feel very privileged, but also, again, as I was saying, you don't really know where it's come from. I think the only thing you can put it down to is that you do it all the time. I mean, I've been writing songs, you know, for 20 years. And even though there might be periods where you stop for a while, you never really stop because you love it so much. The key I would say to songwriters that are starting up or just to be beginning to get their heads together around it is to just keep doing it. I know it sounds a cliche, but you almost cannot not do it because you just have to do it. And, you know, I'm 25 years down the line and still driving here to this podcast. I'm playing a brand new song in my car to, you know, at this moment, which I'm more excited about than anything. So, you know, there is, even though we're talking technical, I suppose, there is that naive, child-loving desire to always write a great little tune. And in fact, before I came here, I was opening up one of these songbooks for all, you know, chords for all the 60s hits. And I'm looking at Bacharach and Hal David songs, you know, looking at Alfie, and you're thinking, God, what a beautiful chord progression. Now, that still motivates me. And I think most of the songwriters that are still doing it and are the ones that are absolutely passionate about the next song they're going to write. What's it going to be? Can it be better?
I just think that's terrific. Just listening to you talk about just the passion of songwriting in your life, because if you're out there and you're trying to be a songwriter and you want to hit, you know, make the instant hits and you want to make the money, I think a lot of times what you get is a lot of fake songs and you get a lot of songs that sound like other people's. And I think one of the successes of a songwriter that can last 20 years like yourself is you have to have that passion that will keep you going through all those years, because...
And I want to throw in here, Mike, because you made me think that there's also 50 songs that aren't good, you know, and then there's three or four that become special. So it is like, as you made me realize, really, I want to make people aware of, is that you do a lot of writing, and maybe out of 60 songs, five are really special. And but it is the passion that makes you even write the bad songs, you know, and you have to see them through. An interesting thing that I want to bring up here for the songwriters is that when you first start off, you don't know how to edit yourself. So you just write it and you think it's great and you record it the way it is. And I'm sure Rob could agree with this, but over a number of years, you start to realize not to finish quite so quickly, to review it, and you learn how to edit yourself. And you know, over a number of songs, over periods of years, you start to realize that your editing is better. And yeah, and you're conscious of what is good and what is not good. You never know at the beginning. You just never know. You've just got to get the songs finished. You only really know after you've been doing it, just like a craftsman, you know, 5 years down the line, you suddenly go, I don't know how I know, but I know this needs a new middle eight, you know.
One of the things I've told songwriters quite a bit is, just along the lines of what you're saying, no one's going to care how long it took you to write the song if they love the song. They don't care if it took a day, a week, a month, a year, or 10 years. If the song hits them, they just don't care.
Yeah.
So there's no reason to rush it for anybody. I mean,
no, totally. As you say, Robert, I would say to when you're first starting, you got to finish them and you got to do them.
Sure. You got to move on.
Yeah, because you're learning and you're learning how to do it. But as you say, you have to be aware, and this is something I'm trying to impart to people, that that one of the things you'll want to learn as a writer is how to edit yourself, you know, and not accept everything that you do as being totally right, you know. Even now, you know, people would say I'm an experienced writer, but I have the luxury of looking at a song over a period of, you know, 2 to 3 weeks on and just playing it around and just going, okay, I know that lyric isn't quite right. But you never really quite get to that place early. It takes a number of years before you're able to dance with your song, able to play with it and not feel like, I've got to finish this, it's got to be done. You know, you start to caress it better as time goes on.
Well, I want to bring Rob into the conversation because you've been a composer for several years, but now you're starting to write songs. Mm-hmm. And before we take the break, why don't you fill us in a little bit on your – just tell us a little bit about your songwriting journey that you're basically starting right now.
Okay, yeah, because I've been passionate about music since I was a little kid, and my big influences were Stevie and the Motown sound, and I used to sit in front of the stereo speakers at my grandmother's house when I was 3 years old and sit and listen to the Supremes and Stevie, and I just loved that stuff. And I studied classical piano, and growing up, I always thought I would be a musician, but I never really had a passion for songwriting. I had a passion for songs. I loved listening to them, and I had a passion for playing keyboards. And as I went to work for Stevie, you know, I got to sit and watch him write songs, and that was a pretty magical experience because he would sit down at the piano and start playing and singing as if he had written it the day before, and then I'd say, well, that's beautiful. When'd you write it? And, oh, just right now. And it was like someone from above was feeding him this stuff. It's just unbelievable to watch him write a song. And it's something I've never gotten used to. I still find it unbelievable, and I just want to smack him in the head. It's so easy for him. Although he's someone who will live with a song for years. I mean, sometimes when we'll finally work on a song for one of his albums, it'll be the 10th time we've cut the song, and he might have demoed it 15 or 20 years earlier even. Stevie is definitely not someone who rushes ever, you know, about anything. But so for years I watched him write songs, and when I started my production company, I started writing a lot of music for commercials, for movie trailers. A lot of it was instrumental, or if it had a vocal, it was advertising music. You know, it was
Hot Pockets.
Yes, the most loathed jingle in history, the Hot Pockets jingle, is one of my I think it's the first jingle I ever wrote that actually had a vocal.
Oh, wait a second. We got the writer of Hot Pockets on one side, yeah, and We Built This City on the other side.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. How can you have these two men in the same room?
Well, you should clarify. What was the award given to We Built This City?
Worst song ever written in the universe.
Oh,
for
wow.
all known time of all existence.
Hey, it's good to be number one.
Hey, really? Hey, they weren't playing number two. They had to play number one to say how much they didn't like it.
Sorry about that, Rob.
No, that's okay.
Thank you for bringing that up, Mike. I really appreciate that.
Anytime we can interject, pain is always appreciated. So I wrote a lot of advertising music, but it was only in the last few years that I started writing songs, and it was basically out of necessity. I decided to do some artist development. I met a 12-year-old singer named Sebastian Mago, who I thought was absolutely amazing, and I decided to develop him as an artist and see if that was something I could do, because I knew he had a huge amount of talent. I thought he could be incredible, but he needed a lot of work and a lot of guidance, and I kind of took it on as a development project. And cutting to the end of the story, 3.5 years later, he signed a major deal with Columbia Records, and you know, the process worked. But partway through that process, I contacted a lot of my friends to try to find songs for him, because the song is the currency in the music business. Nothing else matters if the songs aren't good. And I had a really hard time finding songs for him because he was a very soulful singer, very emotional, but he was also 12, 13 years old. And it's not easy to find material for someone who's a real singer, not a kiddie pop throwaway artist. It's hard to find material for someone like that. And so after looking for a really long time, I decided the only way I'm going to find the songs I'm looking for, because I can't get the real A writers to work with him. He's not signed. You know, he's just a kid. The only way I'm going to find these songs is if I write them myself. And so I said, you know, I've never attempted to do this before, but I know what a great song sounds like. And I'm going to get together with some of my friends who are songwriters and kind of bounce ideas off of them. And I took to it pretty quickly, and I ended up writing a lot of material for him. And that got the bug going in me. Now I'm writing songs constantly. But it was the songs that I wrote for him that were the most honest, emotional songs for him. And that's what got him the record deal. As a matter of fact, we got the record deal in a really old school way. We flew to New York, and meeting after meeting, I played piano and he sang. Wow. No production. Nothing. It was just live performance, and he killed these songs. And these are very emotional songs with really strong hooks, and he nailed them, and the labels were left speechless by him. He really delivered. But so my songwriting started as a necessity because I just couldn't find songs. Now that he's signed, everybody wants to work with him, you know, but yeah. It's never, you know, try dragging an unsigned 13-year-old around to A writers. It's not that easy to get material.
We're going to take a break right now, and when we come back, let's talk about actually writing a song. So I'll see you on the other side.
Have a question for the panel? Would you like to be a guest on the Audio Nowcast and live in the LA area? Email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com.
Hey, welcome back to the Audio Nowcast. And for this second half, we're going to talk a little bit about the nuts and bolts of songwriting. How do you guys start a song? Because there's a lot of people out there that want to be songwriters and they want to write songs, but sometimes they don't get past anything more than just coming up with a really good little melody in their head, and they never execute because sometimes they just get so stifled by just starting. How do you guys start your songs?
It's interesting, Mike, what you just said there about not getting past a certain point. I think that's one of the things that you have to do. You have to stay quite disciplined to say, you know, I'm going to go into my studio or my room where my guitar is or my piano is, and I'm going to stay there for a few hours and try and knock this together. I personally try and make myself turn up for the gig. You know, if you're a songwriter, you go to write songs. So I have a studio at home, and I specifically, you know, set myself a time to go in and an amount of time to get a result. So even though it's an inspirational, a creative time, you still have to be disciplined enough to turn up for the gig. I write a great deal on keyboards, and with today's synthesizers, it's easy to sit down with a drum rhythm or a pad. And I usually have a microphone set up live, and I really will just scat and doodle along. And before you know it, you might have found a chord progression which resonates with you. And I'll sing incoherent lyrics that make no sense at this point, but may lead me into, you know, a journey. And I will tape a lot of my roughs, even with a small cassette player. If I'm playing an acoustic guitar, I'll just record with a small cassette player. If I'm using a synthesizer, I'll have a microphone going straight into Pro Tools. And I try to, sometimes I'll write on an acoustic guitar to get a totally different kind of songwriting, because it's not my main instrument, and it makes me write simple. With keyboards, I tend to write a little more harmonically, and the chords are a little more adventurous. But I think one of the keys to people that are maybe just starting songwriting and maybe frustrated that they get bored or a song doesn't come straight to them, I think one of the keys is to, because I think we all find this, and I find this as a writer, you might just get the verse of something, which is great, but you may not have the chorus, or you might write the chorus and not the verse first. So you have to record everything, have stamina to give it a good shot for an hour or two, then walk away and have a cup of tea, or, which an Englishman I am, I'll have a cup of tea and then walk back in and listen to that. I said earlier in the podcast that editing yourself is a really a useful tool, because if you record all your experiments, then walk away or have a drive for an hour, then come back. For myself, I tend to, the next day when I'm having a shave in the morning, I'll play a CD or a cassette in the background as I'm walking around the house. And I can usually tell when I've walked away from the project if it's resonating, if it's coming through all the hubbub of normal life and you go, good melody. I tend to do things rough at the beginning. Because I think when you do things without thinking, it has to be in tune, it has to be a certain keyboard sound, it has to be really recorded well. You know, excuse my French, but it's a lot of bollocks. You need to get your spirit out. You need to be thinking about the melody and the presence of the whole piece. And I will add that there's so many different ways to start a song. You may have a drum rhythm, a loop. With today's technology that gets you singing with a certain rhythm and gets you into a certain mood. Or you may just have an acoustic guitar which makes you play folky or makes you think more like a religious folk song. And then you may be singing, a cappella, and you might just find a melody. I think there's many different ways to come at writing songs, but to hone that all down, I would say that you have to turn up for the gig and you have to be willing to stay there more than 20 minutes and not get depressed when everything doesn't fall into place. I will interject as well that usually for me personally, I'll be working on a song thinking I'm getting a bit of an idea and I can't break past a certain point, and then I'll say, okay, let me try a different chord progression and a brand new song. And usually when I break into something fresh from after knocking at something on the door for an hour, something comes straight away. Mm-hmm.
I have that happen a lot.
Yeah. So you can be really focused and go, oh, I think this is great. This is really good. But you can't get the next stage. And you stop. Now write a brand new song. And that brand new song will just flow like a river. But again, you have to have the stamina to sit in the room with that keyboard, with that guitar, with that microphone turned on, with that cassette recorder, and give it a good shot every day.
Do you think, excuse me, Rob, really quick, do you think a lot of the new songwriters out there make a mistake of maybe putting too much pressure on themselves, that they never get going because they want to write the hit, and so it never gets to that next level because they put a lot of pressure on themselves? I mean, I would think the one of the first things you want to do is just relax and then just go with the moment and let the music flow, as opposed to try to write a hit. Now, I was going to say, you know, that would be a great rule number one, but you know, when I think about it, Rob, when you were working with Sebastian, you had to think about writing a hit because you wanted to get this guy signed. So
no, but you know what? I've been writing music long enough to realize that when you set out to write a hit, you never do. My goal with writing for Sebastian was to find emotional songs that a 13-year-old soulful singer could connect with. I knew if that connection happened, then you have a potential hit. We're editing that, and we're editing. You have no choice but to edit that.
That's not going to be edited.
oh, yes, it will. No, it probably won't, so I better continue. If you can get that emotional connection happening, you may have a hit on your hands. But I realized my job was to try to find songs that labels might realize, oh, here's a kid relating to an emotional song. So I didn't set out to write a hit. It never works to set out saying we're specifically going to follow a formula that's going to give us a hit, because it doesn't.
So you were still writing for that moment, for that song. You weren't even thinking about hit, not a hit. I wasn't thinking about hit or not a hit.
I definitely was writing with a goal. The goal was to find a way for a kid to emotionally connect with a mature song, because you can't have a 13-year-old singing about all of their life experiences, because they've been to the mall and they've been to McDonald's and that's about it. You know, it's hard for a 13-year-old to sing a song that's written for a 30-year-old. They can't sing about lost love and all these other things. So I did set out with the goal of finding emotional stuff for him, but not trying to write a hit.
I think it's a good point to bring up as well, even though we might be sounding here like, hey, you know, you sit down and you just write your art and something commercial happens. I think that takes over, that you write what you're good at writing. But it doesn't hurt to think, I'm inspired by this kind of groove.
Oh,
or,
definitely.
Or I enjoyed Sledgehammer by Peter Gabriel. It would be nice for to knock something in the shape that has that color about it.
No question.
I do find that, as Rob said, when I've sat down with a task to turn something out commercially, I struggle. But at the same time, I'm trying to think to myself, and I think most writers are, how am I going to communicate massively to people that they're going to love this song? It's very rare when you get a chance to write a song that is so personal to you that you don't really care that it doesn't communicate. And sometimes that can be pretty amazing. But really, I think most of us as writers sit down thinking, I can't wait to play this to a lot of people, even my friend, my girlfriend, my manager. And I think we're all inspired by what we've loved in the past. And I find it hard to believe when people say, this is just me, with no influences. Well, we're all influenced. I know that when I'm writing a song now, there's elements that I loved about the Beatles, there's elements I loved about Genesis, there's elements I loved about great soul music. So I do think that, you know, as a guidance for writers as well, it's you do tend to sit down and think, I want to communicate to a lot of people. So I'm not just going to get wrapped up in my art and think that something magic is going to happen. I think subliminally there's something just behind saying, you know, we'd like this to really communicate rhythm, timing of the song, be nice to have a chorus. That does come into it as well.
Definitely. Yeah. When I had decided to write these songs for the first time, you know, to turn myself into a songwriter, I had already had a very long history of writing music for an assignment. You know, if you're doing a movie trailer, if it's a Godzilla trailer, you're not going to do, you know, a Happy Little Waltz or something. You know, you have to, it's music for an assignment. And so for me, writing a song was just like giving myself the assignment. Instead of a client who would pay me, I would write the song with the assignment of, you know, making that emotional connection, you know, whatever I decided the song should be.
It's a great thing you said there, Rob, though, about saying who would pay me, because, you know, we write our songs hoping that people will record them or use them so that when you do get paid, you can continue doing what you love to do, which is to continue writing songs, build your studio, buy a new guitar. So, you know, I don't want it to come across as there's some kind of, you know, religious artistic man sat in the dark.
Oh, hell no.
Yeah. So, no, it's a real balance, isn't it? There's a balance. Yeah.
One thing I wanted to add to what you were saying, I mean, I face the same discipline issues. You know, I need to tell myself, okay, today we're going into the studio and we're writing a song. And I've gotten pretty good at doing that. But I'll find if I'm sitting hammering it away at a song and it's just not coming together. I mean, I'll definitely give it the old college try or college dropout try in my case. I'll give it that try, but if I'm not feeling it, I'll either switch to another song like you were saying, or sometimes what I'll find is I'll just walk away from it and then at the most unexpected times, something will just hit me. I mean, sometimes it's in the shower or, you know, I could be outside walking or whatever. And I am constantly calling my voicemail from crazy places, calling my answering machine, and just singing melody ideas. And most of the best stuff I've written, the ideas have started in the studio, but for the what I would say is the very best stuff, my favorite stuff that I've written, the inspiration hit me at some other random place after doing the groundwork in the studio.
And this is a really great point about songs as well, because of how you can never really nail down how you know a kind of procedure that always works the same way. In fact, these dreams took me 15 minutes to write, yet In the House of Stone and Light took me 3 months.
Really?
Yeah. And, you know, We Built the City took 2 weeks. And I'm aware of some songs need a lot of building. Some songs won't allow you to get them straight away. And yet some just fall out of you. And I remember with These Dreams that I'd written it in 15 minutes. And I remember calling my manager and saying, listen to this. And this happened. Interestingly enough, Bernie Taupin, always different way of writing, which I know Mike was going to talk about, is he would give a lyric to me up front when usually most people would write the music and do the words after.
Yeah, that's actually what I was gonna bring up is the lyric. How was that writing with a lyric like that right up front without any melody or anything?
You know, it was real natural to me. I'd always been a fan of Elton and Goodbye Yellow Brick Road when I was a kid, so it was pretty magical to be working with Bernie. But everybody said this is going to be a tough one. You know, he's gonna give you a lyric and not even be in the room. And I found it really wonderful because I didn't have to really concentrate on what he was saying. And I know Elton has said this as well. I was concentrating on the flavor of how the lyrics were rhythmically going to work. And it was a breeze. I sometimes had to come back and look at the song after and go, what have I just written? What does he mean by this? Because I was really doing it by just like reading poetry and letting it all happen. A lot of writers I spoke to after said, oh, I could never do that. That must be so strange. I found it to be very easy. And actually look forward to it. It took a lot of pressure off.
Yeah, actually, that's a really good point, because if you're a songwriter and you can write really good lyrics, you might as well just write your lyrics and let what you're going to say.
Different people. I mean, I worked with Hal David, and Hal David would only write the words when he was sat down with you actually working, where Bernie wouldn't want to be in the studio with you. He would just say, here comes another fax with a new lyric. And I'd have to call him up and say, in fact, with These Dreams, he sent me this lyric, and it was called Boys in the Mist, and it was written for Stevie Nicks. As you can tell with the lyrics, the ethereal lyrics, it was really written for her and Fleetwood Mac, and it was called Boys in the Mist. And as I was writing the song, the bridge had These Dreams in it, and I thought, God, the bridge sounds really great, but I'm not really getting on with Boys in the Mist. And I was very nervous about calling him because I'd only just started to work with him. How do you say to Bernie Taupin, I want to change your lyrics, mate?
Yeah.
You know, that's the first song we wrote. So I gave him a call and said, how do you feel if it's not Boys in the Mist because Stevie Nicks isn't interested in it and I changed it to These Dreams? And he went, no problem. Elton does that all the time. Move it around if you want to. And So the bridge, you know, became the chorus, and the chorus became one of the verses. But, you know, you have to be very, very, very conscious that, you know, the melody, to me, always, and this is a good point, designates the song. I think you can have a great song with bad lyrics if the melody's good. To me, melody always will win the day. Great if a song has terrific lyrics as well. But really, the most important thing I think in all great songs is the melody.
Yeah, which brings up the next point is do you look for the melody first and then build your textures around it, or sometimes is it the other way around? You build your textures and then your melody, you kind of see it starting to poke its way through.
To me, it's always the melody. I mean, I'm wrapped up in that it has to be memorable melodically. It's interesting when you're writing, as I've got older, songs have slowed down and you tend to be writing much more mid-tempo, because I think when you're younger, you're much more in tune with rhythm and groove and feeling that. But as you get older, you're thinking about melody, you're thinking about more about emotion. Personally, for me, it's been that way. And I've had to go seeking for the more up-tempo songs because I'm more interested in what the texture of a mid-tempo song is. The way you walk, the way you breathe, there's usually a mid-tempo feel about it. And you can make, and when I was young, I tended to not know how to write emotionally. As I got older, there was more things to say. I was more in touch with what I wanted to say emotionally. You could be writing about death, you could be writing about love in a different kind of way. But I find that sometimes it's really exciting to sit down and just let the drum machine go on a very strange groove, and rhythms do change the way you're going to sing and the kind of phrasing you're going to do. But personally, I get more gratification now as a veteran writer in knowing that melodically and emotionally it's more powerful, because I think those songs last. The emotional songs last. We're talking about My Way. We're talking about, you know, even Peter Gabriel with Don't Give Up. We can think of these classic songs, even American Pie. We're going to go, these songs have such a strong emotional melodic content, you know. And usually the mid-tempo, you know, they last forever.
When you say mid-tempo, what are you talking like,
80 beats per minute, 81, 82, you know, you can get around to, you know, touch 90, but really 70, 74 up to 81. It's a place that I can really do well in. I can really do well there. You move me up to 100 these days, I'm a bit too fast. Can't get all my words in. But, you know, my first hit, Dancing in Heaven, was like 121 beats per minute, you know? And I go like, well, how young was I when I was singing that high? And now I'm saying, you know, give me an 80 beat per minute and I'll give you a really good emotional love song. But, you know, it's interesting because it happened to me naturally that I found out when I was writing my solo album that I was having to push my tempos up because I naturally wanted to write in that mid space. But also, when I was younger, it was hard to write a mid-paced melodic song. It was just harder. I just found it that way, that, you know, how do you get into writing that real, you know, emotional song, you know, Hey Jude by the Beatles. How do you write that? You know, it's not easy to write those songs. It's more common to me now to go that way, but they're the harder songs to write. The songs that are also simple songs.
Well, the thing about a mid-tempo song too is 80 beats per minute. You know, you're not going to hide behind a groove. You know, it's going to stand on the melody, and the melody has to be strong.
You bring up a good point about the groove. I think one of the beginning mistakes that a lot of songwriters make is they don't differentiate between production and writing.
Yeah.
And it's very easy to get so wrapped up in the beat and the groove and the samples you're using and all of that technology, and the song ends up suffering. Because
how many times, Rob, have we done a demo and we think we've got the song good, and then we start to produce it, and then on the third day you go, oh my God, I'm polishing something here that doesn't have really much substance.
Yeah, there's not a song here. One of my favorite sayings is, no one ever left a concert humming the drums. Mm-hmm. You know, the melody and the lyrics are the song. All the production, it's obviously critically important, but it's not the song.
Yeah.
You know, the song is, and when I was developing Sebastian, one of the requirements I had, no matter what kind of song we were doing, because he was a kid, we had to do some real young dance stuff, and there was lots of hip hop, and one of my requirements for any song we were going to consider is, no matter what style of music it was, you had to be able to just hum it to yourself or sing it to yourself. There had to be a song there, no matter what kind of production it was going to be and what style of music it was going to be. I think that's a beginner mistake for somebody who wants to really write a song. Worry about the song. I mean, if you have fun doing the production stuff too, obviously it's important, but
It's an interesting thing as well. There was a day I was playing Superstition by Stevie and listening to that. And there again, here you get a great groove and a great clavinet groove that also has, you know, a really great melody on it with very Superstitious. And, you know, some of those great songs that are a little more, that are above up tempo but just have a groove to them, they also, you know, they're pretty unique when they come along and pretty special. So it's almost like sometimes when you don't want to stop people sometimes trying to find the groove as well, mm-hmm. that can also inspire something which is really original. I mean, some of the Earth, Wind & Fire tracks, you know, the first thing you remember is Let's Groove Tonight is just the way the riff is and the groove is.
Definitely.
And it's rare, but when that happens as well, it's something you've got to be aware of. It can happen.
But you can put you can have an amazing groove and put a great melody on it or a terrible melody.
True.
And I definitely gravitate towards stuff with a great melody.
Yeah. And I guarantee you, if you put a terrific groove and have a terrible melody, it's going to come out and it's going to go away.
But that's a lot of what's on the radio right now is amazingly well-produced, great grooves with terrible, forgettable melodies and hooks.
From what I'm listening in to both of you guys talk, it's like, you know, put away the groove and just start with a melody, you know, a melody.
Well, I don't want to say that you can't write a good song that groove, but I mean, sometimes I start with a melody. Sometimes I do find myself starting with a lyric if I have like one catchphrase that I think is just going to be a really strong catchphrase. I might start writing the song around that catchphrase.
Like Hot Pockets.
Yeah. No, I wish I could come up with something else that strong. I think I peaked in 1991 with that. That's a classic. But I've written, I'd say it's about 50-50 whether I've started with a melodic line or a lyric. But the thing that I don't like is if you have an amazing sounding groove, like if you have GarageBand and you work up a great groove and then you think that groove is so hot that no matter what you put on top of it is going to be hit. That's just not the way
it
works.
That's a very good point. And also, though, I think to get us inspired as songwriters, sometimes you need to come in and you want to play that drum rhythm and play that chord over that groove just to get you going. You know, whatever gets the songwriter inspired. Sometimes I feel like just picking up an acoustic guitar and being Johnny Cash for an hour. And sometimes I feel like coming in and saying, let's play the Burundi drums, you know, by a nation of African drumming, and let's see what comes on top of that. It's, you know, it's, and I'm talking to talking to songwriters with getting them to go into the room, what gets them ticking, what turns them over. And sometimes I need to, listen to some great music by other artists.
About inspiration. It really is.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's go to the next step, because I think you've really brought some great ideas, and although there is no right way to start a song, you know, these are definitely good ideas on how to get yourself rolling. Let's change the lyrics really quick, because I think now that you've got a great melody, and I know you, Martin, you know, you've worked with people who have given you lyrics like Bernie, but you've also done your own lyrics. I think lyrics, you know, that's another place where songs just have a tendency of just dying right then and there, because even though a great melody can overcome bad lyrics, there's nothing that screams, you know, bad song than just horrible lyrics, you know, where it just sounds so amateur. How do you approach your lyric writing?
I was very fortunate in the beginning of my career that everybody saw me as the person who wrote the music, and they would put lyricists with me. Hence, Bernie Taupin. I worked with Hal David. I worked with Robbie Robertson. I worked with a great deal of professional lyricists that were just lyricists in their own way. Ali Willis and people like this. And it was, again, for me, I was very lucky, a great education, because here I was just writing the music and these people were writing lyrics with me or giving me lyrics. And I was able to see how different they were. Hal David was extremely different to Bernie Taupin. Robbie Robertson was extremely different to Ali Willis.
Now, when you say different, are you talking the way their meter is, the way they rhyme, the way they use their words?
Well, here we are. We're talking about, you know, why you're different to me. They had their own character. To sum it up, you know, Robbie Robertson was very biblical, and you'd see his overtones of how he worked with Bob Dylan in the band. There was definitely a kind of biblical feeling, like Leonard Cohen. Bernie Taupin had a real knack for understanding rhythmic writing. Sometimes when he gave me a lyric, he'd say, think of, The Bitch's Back. That's how I wrote this song. Or Brown Sugar by the Stones. That kind of metering. Because he was a fan himself. But he also, Bernie was very, very unique in that he had a great pop sensibility. But he also knew, if you look at Elton's lyrics, how to give you a different kind of deepness. You know, right from Your Song, you know, right through to Rocket Man. Although these were pop songs, they had a great sophistication about them, which were almost, you know, my poetry. And then when Hal David had a really terrific natural ability to be simple, he knew how to hit you right on the head with a very, very simple lyric, which you might at first go, this is too simple. Then when you sang it, you'd go, God, he's really hitting you right in the chest to where it should happen. When I come to do my own lyrics, as Rob said, sometimes I have titles that I've already written down in a little book and said I would really like to use this kind of theme down the line. Mainly for me, though, I will sing phonetically on a demo. And you make sounds. And then I would think, these sounds sound so good to the music. I need to make some of these sounds fit what the words are. In fact, House of Stone and Light, you know, it starts off with O Mount Kailas. But I'm singing on the song, O my Abbas. And that's how the demo was, O my Abbas. But I thought, if I go, there's a place, it's wrong. I have to go, O my Abbas, O Mount Kailas. That's a place that I found out that people walk around a mountain and they take a piece of clothing off to get rid of their sins and to free themselves up. So I really feel that phonetic vocals, for me personally, the sounds of vocals, then try and fit words that sound like that to your theme. Usually words come after for me. The music and the phonetic vocals are there. I have tons of demos of all my songs of me just sounding like I'm a mad Frenchman.
You know what, though? You bring up a really good point. One of the things I've found with lyrics is the best lyrics, this isn't 100% rule because there are no 100% rules, but usually the best lyrics are lyrics that you sing in a rhythm that's similar to how you would say them. Mm-hmm. You know, there are people who go against that, Michael Jackson, Stevie. There are definitely great singers who go against that rule. But for the most part, and I found this true in advertising too, advertising music, if you sing it in a similar rhythm to how you'd speak it, it ends up sounding natural. And a lot of times that's how I find my melodies and my rhythms for my melodies is I think I love this line of lyrics. How do I say it? And what does it sound like when I say it? And how could I turn that into a melody? That's just one of the tricks I use.
That's a really good point, because that right there can really just take your song up a notch, because when your lyrics stick to your song, then it just sounds a little bit more polished. I mean, there's nothing.
There's a natural place, right? Mike. There's a natural place where lyrics actually work with the music. There's a natural. You have to go searching for that.
Exactly. And one of the things you can tell with like a bad song or, you know, a really amateur song is where the lyrics, they should be in the next room from the song, because they just are not laying on top of it. And it sounds, I guess, forced. Mm-hmm. That's where you get that the lyrics sound forced.
Or any song where they use dancing and romancing. It's been one of my bugaboos since I was a kid.
Dancing and romancing. You really gave a really good tip with the phonetic singing, because I had the honor and privilege of just working on a little song with Martin. And I mean, I wrote a basic melody, and just to hear him scat on top of it, and then some of the lyric just came just off your scatting. And it was just really amazing how that, you know, if you're really stuck for lyrics, just scat on top of your
melody. Well, that's a good
melody.
Point about being brave and being free. You know, you can sit down, most writers, and they'll just dink away with their guitar, and they'll hardly say anything, and they'll try to be playing properly and everything. But you've almost got to let your spirit go, because you'll find some of your best work when you're able to be brave enough to make mistakes. You know, the mistakes are sometimes, you know, it's cliche, but they are brilliant. And don't worry if you're singing in tune. But you'll find that some of the first things you record, if you're free and not being too uptight, even if you're collaborating with people, you know, let your skin go, you know, be free, that you'll find some of the first things you ever do are the most magical, and you'll be chasing that all the time, you know. So that's why you need to ever take a tape recorder going at all times. But I do want to say that to writers is that when you are writing, try and be free, you know, really let yourself go. And I think it's really important that you shed your skin when you're writing, and you allow yourself to make mistakes. You know, you've got to, this is a thing we haven't brought up about collaborating as well. You know, if you are going to write with somebody, you've got to trust them that you can be yourself. Because I know when I first started, you're thinking, am I playing the right chords? You know, does my voice sound right? You know, and you've got to get through that. And that takes a little bit of time. But if you can become quite, spiritual about it and make some noises, learn some chords, play them right, play them wrong, and tape yourself, you'll find that something quite special will occur if you're not too uptight.
it seems to me that that's probably the key of the whole thing. You know, it's just don't take yourself too seriously and don't put that pressure on yourself, because even with what we were talking about before with getting the melody and everything, just kind of go in there
and keep doing it. You know, it doesn't happen overnight. You know, your best songs are going to be well down the line. You know, it's going to take a while, and you have to just, as anything, you know, you have to keep knocking away. You have to practice, and you have to have the stamina. I mean, a huge word is stamina. You know, you have to keep coming back and going, six of these songs are okay. One of them was brilliant. You know, if you think of a person's repertoire and all their songs, they probably, people, you know, in general, you'd say, God, I've written maybe 10 really songs that I'm really happy about. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe 20 others are good, 40 are terrible. But it's like, you know, you don't always play every game of sport wonderfully. You don't always win every game. So you have to have stamina to keep turning up for the game every day.
And I would actually add to that, one of the beginner mistakes that I see people make is they get married to their early ideas on a song and can't imagine changing a part of the song. They might have a chorus that they love the first and second line. The third line's okay, yeah, but the first and second lines are great and the third line's good enough, so they just leave it that way. And one of my things is, you know what? You can record it the way it is, then set it aside and try to come up with something better.
Yeah.
You know what? You do. You always end up coming up with something better. And one of the things that I'm constantly trying to help people with is don't get too married to your ideas, because you may have heard it a billion times and you're used to it, but other people are going to be hearing it for the first time. And if that third line could have been stronger,
yeah,
you know, you're just selling yourself short. So record your idea and set it aside and try to come up with something better. If you don't succeed in coming up with something better, you have your first idea. You can always go back to it. There's no harm in trying to better it.
And over a period of time, you get better. I mean,
always.
And so, you know, 25 years down the line now for me writing, the best thing that's happened to me is, as you've just said, Rob, I'm able to put things to one side and say, I'll look at that again tomorrow, able to edit myself. And also, I think I know by now what I'm doing quite good and what I'm not doing quite good. And in the early stages, you don't.
No, you have to develop that toolkit.
You've got to be an apprentice. You've got to be aware that you're starting and that you will be really good down the line.
Mm-hmm. If you keep doing it.
Yes.
Just getting older is not enough of a exactly. qualification. You have to really do it.
Yeah. Well, you know what? I think this is a really good place for us to stop on this one in songwriting, because we're going to have to
continue. We were about to get to the real secret.
The golden rule.
Well, you know that one thing that if you do it, you always have a hit?
Yeah.
Oh, we can talk about that next
time. You don't
want
to bring that up
now? No, not this
time. We'll do it next
time. No, but because there's so much – you know, with songwriting, there's so much more that I want to get into, and we're just going to have to do another one. And that's, once you wrote the song, where do you go from there?
Right,
you
know, the business of it, the publishing.
The business, the publishing.
Oh, that.
How to protect
and getting
yourself.
Your songs played and playing them to people, and have bravery to play them to people.
You know, we're going to do this again, and we're going to talk about, I guess, the business side of things. But I just want to thank you, Martin, for giving us a little bit of schooling on how to start.
My pleasure.
If there's anything that I got out of this, let's see if we can encapsulate this, you know, basically, just do it.
Yeah, and have that passion and that stamina.
You just have to write songs.
You have to love doing it enough that if no one ever hears your songs, you're still happy you wrote them.
Yeah, I can definitely see that thing, because, you know, I can just see both of you guys, even if you weren't making a living doing this, you'd be in your studios, you'd be, you know, with a guitar, with a piano, and you'd just be making music.
Or selling the stuff off to survive, I guess.
All right. Well,
what if anyone has questions about this process?
If you have any questions, you can always email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com. Well, thank you, Rob, for bringing that
no
up.
No problem. It's really fun to hear from everybody. So
yeah,
please email us.
Please email. And if you want to come in and join the panel, you are more than welcome to email us if you live in the Los Angeles area, and join us when we do one of these podcasts, and you can be on the panel and ask questions and have your shot of trying to impersonate Bobby when he's not here. All right. Well, I want to, you know, thank both you guys, and also want to thank Andrew Chavone, who engineering tonight. So welcome back, Andrew.
Great stuff.
And this is Mike Rodriguez, and we'll see you next time.
Have a question for the panel? Would you like to be a guest on the Audio Nowcast and live in the L.A. area? Email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com. Thanks for listening to this week's edition of the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Westwave Audio.